All right, good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And the first order of business will be to take the roll. Ms. Niederhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher. Schumacher. Ackland.
Present.
Backer. Backer.
Backer present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damath.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison present.
Munson.
Munson present.
Fryer.
Present.
Quam.
Excused.
Present.
Oh, okay.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niederhofer. The next order of business will be to move the minutes, and we have three sets of minutes that were sent out. We got just a little bit behind, but we have the minutes of March 12th, March 15th, and March 16th. Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, would you like to move them all at once?
I think so, yeah. I think that would be okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I would like to make a motion to move the minutes for March 12th, 15th, and 16th.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So is there any discussion to these three sets of minutes? All right. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of approval of the minutes from March 12th, 15th, and 16th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes of those three dates are approved. Thank you, members. Okay, so I'm very excited today to have Representative Richardson here with House File 1200. And because Representative Richardson is not on the committee, the chair will move House File 1200, the second engrossment, to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Representative Richardson, welcome, and please go ahead and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1200 would create a statewide paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program. The program is modeled after our state's unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much-needed safety net for families. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a family member that is sick, or to recover themselves from illness. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. Unfortunately, the reality for the majority of Minnesotans is that it's not that simple. Only about 13% of the Minnesota workforce has paid family leave through an employer, and an estimated 44% have access through an employer-provided temporary disability program. The lack of access demonstrates structural inequality. The majority of Minnesota workers are excluded. Those who are currently left out of paid family and medical leave programs are often those who need the access the most and are facing the most economic insecurity. Lower paid employees are disproportionately left out of the paid family leave programs. Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and other workers of color are less likely to have access, and women are also facing disparities when it comes to access to paid family leave programs. Most Minnesota workers cannot afford to take time off without pay. Without access to wage replacement, workers with serious health conditions put off treatment or return to work sooner than recommended, jeopardizing recovery and long-term health. Unfortunately, there's a legacy in this country of inequities and occupational segregation that has resulted in uneven safety nets. In fact, when the Social Security Act passed, there were exemptions that did not allow farmers or domestics to participate, and as a result, 65% of Black people across the country were ineligible for benefits. Today in Minnesota, we see inequities in who has access to the safety net of paid family and medical leave and those who do not. The current system serves to deepen unacceptable disparities and inequality in the state. The holes in the safety net are so large, the majority of our hardworking and lowest income Minnesotan families are falling through. The key to this bill is that it would ensure that the vast majority of hardworking Minnesotans would not be placed in the impossible choice of caring for themselves, a loved one, or a paycheck. A serious illness or injury can devastate a family's economic security quickly, as many Minnesotans are only one, two, or a few paychecks away from financial disaster. In the midst of a global pandemic, it has become even more clear. Illness can strike at any time, and families, just like businesses, need safety nets. The National Partnership for Women and Families has conducted national surveys on paid family leave, and in the most recent survey, 8 in 10 voters and overall 84% of voters support permanent paid family and medical leave. A state-operated paid family and medical leave insurance program has the potential to improve economic stability and health outcomes. There is research that pregnancy-related complications and recovery are the most prevalent type of medical leave claims for states with paid family and medical leave. Research on California found significant reductions in the share of low birth weight babies and preterm births as a result of its paid leave program. In fact, low birth weights decreased by 3.2% and preterm births decreased by 6.6%. Using March of Dimes data, a 6.6 decrease in preterm births in Minnesota could save over $19 million annually in excess health care costs associated with premature births. There's also research on how paid leave impacts elder care. Family caregivers are one of the most important factors in allowing seniors to age in place. Research in California has found that paid leave programs reduce nursing home utilization rates by 11%. A similar drop in Medicaid-funded Minnesota nursing home placement costs could yield savings to the state and federal government at an estimated $62 million. In the U.S., nearly one-third of women who give birth do not take any maternity leave, and one in four women return to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. Paid leave matters for child health and development. Women who have access to paid leave are 93% more likely to be in the workforce in 9 to 12 months after a child's birth than women who take no leave. For women who do not have access to this leave, the study found that nearly 30% will drop out of the workforce within a year after welcoming a child, and one in five will not return for over a decade. Working families with paid leave are more economically secure and are significantly less likely to use public support programs in the year after their child's birth. Minnesotans want to work and take care of their families, and this bill can help make that a reality. We also have the added benefit and ability to take advantage of lessons learned from other states that have implemented similar programs that have proven effective, beneficial, and sustainable, even in the midst of the COVID pandemic. I have a number of author testifiers and would request, Madam Chair, that you recognize Ms. Deborah Fitzpatrick.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Richardson. That's a great opening. And if you don't mind, I have Commissioner Malcolm first on my agenda, and I do know that she needs to. She has a time crunch. So if it's okay with you, I would go to her first.
Of course, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. And just to, I'm really pleased that Commissioner Malcolm was able to join us today, because it really emphasizes what Representative Richardson's been saying about the health impact of this bill. And of course, this is the Health Committee. So welcome, Commissioner. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members and Representative Richardson. Good afternoon, Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. I just want to thank Representative Richardson for that excellent explanation of the benefits of a paid family and medical leave bill. We've talked for years, frankly, about the economic imperative and the holes in the safety net, as the representative mentioned. Been a little more recent that we've talked about the direct health impacts of paid family leave as well. In the past year, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, has certainly brought this home in even more stark terms. I can recall a couple of committee hearings over the past years, Madam Chair, when we've talked about the multiple ways in which paid family leave makes people healthier at both the individual and the community level. And I think Representative Richardson just did a great job laying out some of the most powerful statistics there. This is an extremely strong and clear example of the kind of upstream preventive intervention that we know pays such huge dividends. Representative Richardson talked about the impact on maternal and child health, and we've seen dramatic reductions, as she said, in low birth weight, preterm birth, infant mortality, reduced rates of hospital readmissions after birth. So this is not only good for health, it's good for healthcare cost as well. It's a true win-win, and it's such a powerful way to address directly some of the stark health inequities that we see in terms of maternal and child outcomes. The representative made that point, that it's the very people who most need the protection who are the least likely to have access to this benefit. Certainly the other health benefits that we know, even after birth, we know that families with paid family medical leave, their kids are much more likely to have regular healthy child, well child checkups, get the screenings, get the immunizations, get all the things that can help those children avoid health problems in their early growing years. The reductions in stress that the ability for paid family and medical leave have. And we know so much more in recent years about the direct health impacts of stress. We know what a cause of health problems that is, and what an exacerbator of other health problems stress is. And economic security is such a key part of stress, as we know. And we've certainly seen that in the COVID pandemic. That's been one of the negative health impacts beyond the infectious disease itself, has been the health harms caused by the economic disruptions caused by COVID. I appreciate too that Representative Richardson mentioned care for others over the entire lifespan. The human cost of not being able to care for a loved one when ill, whether that's with a short term or a chronic or an end of life condition, the lack of paid family medical leave not only robs people of that very human experience, but again, it is a less costly and far more satisfying way to avoid reliance on institutional care for providing that all important need. And just to take one moment on the impacts directly that we've seen on the spread of disease and that during this COVID pandemic due to the lack of this benefit. And it's no surprise, but it is an absolute compounding factor in the fact that we've seen some of the populations the hardest hit from COVID, the most likely to be exposed by virtue of their work conditions and their living conditions, and the most likely to expose others by virtue of the lack of some of these benefits, unable to stay home, unable to help care for and make it possible for infected people to isolate and quarantine. There will be academic studies written, to be sure, about the impact of the lack of paid family and medical leave on the preventable spread of this infectious disease. But we've already seen it. We've seen it in our communities. We've seen it in our case investigations at the health department. This is a very real risk factor for spread. It's part of how we saw some of the first outbreaks spread from workplace sectors into the community and beyond. So I think this is an extremely timely bill. It's been a critical bill from a health policy perspective for many years, but what we've just are living through together with COVID-19 just gives us another dimension to understand that you really cannot separate out individual health from community health when it comes to an infectious disease pandemic such as this. So I very much appreciate the chance to just lend my thanks and my support to the very good case that Representative Richardson laid out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Malcolm. We appreciate you being here today. I'm gonna go then to Deborah Fitzpatrick. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to ground the committee in the way this POP program works. So I'm going to share a couple of quick slides in order to do that. Wanted to, again, my name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I am here today. I'm frozen. Sorry, I froze there. Sorry, can you hear me now?
Oh yeah, we can. You didn't okay. freeze for us. Maybe the screen, maybe the screen share did. Yeah, and Ms. Fitzpatrick, if you could tell us who you're with as well.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
Got distracted there. Yes, hi, Deborah Fitzpatrick. I'm currently the Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs for Children's Defense Fund, but I'm also here today in a prior role. I was at the University of Minnesota Humphrey School, led the research team that did the design and implementation study for the state of Minnesota. That was legislatively mandated in 2016, and we updated that again last year, or 2 years ago actually now in 2019, to reflect the significant number of additional states that have adopted these programs since 2015. So wanted to, again, like I said, ground the committee in how the program works. It is a contributory social insurance program, and that is the dominant model for the way these this benefit is delivered in 8 U.S. states and most of the countries around the world. That just means that most employers and workers are contributing into a state fund based on wages. The premium that's being paid is around $3 per week for the employee and employer for a median worker earning $52,000 a year, just as a reference point. There are a couple of exceptions. Employers with comparable benefits are able to provide their own benefit program if they choose to. And self-employed workers are able to join the program if they desire. Eligibility for the program is based on attachment to the workforce and earnings, plus the need for qualifying leave. Important for this committee, healthcare providers in most cases, most types of leave are certifying that need for leave. And then workers are making a claim on this state fund for the financial support that they receive while they're on leave. And as Representative Richardson mentioned, House File 1200 builds on many unemployment insurance definitions and processes just to help reduce employer burdens so that it's a seamless between the way UI operates and this program operates, and also to help ensure a successful build out, including our ability to build on some UI IT. So there's a lot of reasons that social insurance is the way that this program, these benefits are delivered. I wanted to touch on three important ones. First of all, it's a portable benefit. I think that's really critically important given the way our economy is evolving, with many workers having multiple jobs, hourly workers, effectively the low-wage workers that Representative Richardson were mentioning that are traditionally cut out of these kinds of benefits. The workers also, you know, switch jobs frequently. And so this portable benefit then allows those different employer wages to kind of stack together and provide that benefit based on a variety of employers. And then again, workers are receiving that support not from an employer, but from the state fund during their leave. This approach also creates the broadest possible risk pool, and that really keeps the costs low for everyone, both employers and employees. The way the bill is structured, it splits those costs evenly between workers and employers. It's important to note that this also creates the levels the benefits playing field in a number of ways, by geography, by size of employer. Also, I think important to note by the employee need for leave. Right now, if an employer has more workers that need to take a leave in any given year, they don't really have any control over that. But under the current situation, they are having to figure out how to manage those leaves on their own. Finally, it's a popular and durable approach because everyone is contributing. It's an earned benefit. And then everyone has that ability to access that support when they need it. I'll quickly through some of the benefit structure a little bit at a high level, and we can answer questions later as they come up.
Yeah, and Ms. Fitzpatrick, I don't know if you need to focus on the details so much. I mean, it's good to maybe hit the highlights since This is making many, many stops, and we want to focus on the health aspects today.
This is my last one. So I will say that the program allows up to 12 weeks for a worker's own serious health condition. That is important to note, the number one reason that people use these programs. Two-thirds of the costs associated with this program, while family leave gets a lot of attention, it's actually the medical leave portion of this program that affects most people. Intermittent leave is allowed. That allows people to deal with chronic and intermittent conditions like cancer that require long-term treatment. And again, just want to reiterate that healthcare providers certify the need for the leave and the length of the leave. Much has been made about workers taking 24 weeks of leave every year. Workers don't just get to take leave whenever they want under this program. It is connected to, again, that for the most part, that certification. So I'll stop there and be available for questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. And great. Thank you. Sorry, you were perfect. When I saw all that on the slide, I was like, uh-oh, we're going into the weeds. But that was just absolutely perfect. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have Dr. Hannah Lichtzen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much for having me here, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Hannah Lichtzen. My pronouns are she and her. I am a primary care doctor in Minneapolis, and today on behalf of nearly 1,000 pediatricians in Minnesota, I'm here representing the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, where I serve as both a board member and the co-chair of our policy committee. I'm here to discuss the importance of paid family and medical leave for the health and well-being of Minnesotan children and their families. We have a crisis of infant mortality in Minnesota. Babies born into Black and Indigenous families are more than two times as likely to die in their first year of life compared with white infants. Disparities like this result from systemic neglect of these communities, from a system that is rooted in white supremacy. Usually these situations are hard to resolve, but in this case, we have a solution. We know that giving parents access to paid family and medical leave reduces infant mortality and improves the health of new parents. But because of the same systemic racism that puts these families at higher risk of illness, families in these communities are less likely to have access to paid family and medical leave through their employers. We can save the lives of our most vulnerable young children by giving all Minnesotans access to paid family and medical leave. Parental leave, as you've heard, is associated with increased rates of breastfeeding, well-child checks, vaccinations, and timely visits when infants become sick. For example, during the first few months of life, newborns don't have the protection they need from a strong immune system, and so they need immediate evaluation anytime they have a fever. But if parents are back at work without access to paid leave, their children are less likely to get this life-saving care. These are only some of the reasons that paid parental leave is known to reduce rates of infant mortality. And as a result, the lack of guaranteed paid parental leave harms the children of our state. As pediatricians, our calling is to protect and advance the health of all children. Our children cannot speak to you directly, so I'm here on their behalf. We need to come together as a state to ensure that every child has a chance to live, be healthy, and thrive. We cannot solve this problem in our exam rooms, but you can save lives here at the Capitol. And so that's why I'm here on behalf of Minnesota AAP to ask you to vote in support of House File 1200. Thank you so much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions when the time comes.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lichtzen, for being here and for your testimony today. Yeah, do please stay in case there are questions. Okay, Dr. Rod Christensen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. My name is Rod Christensen. I'm a retired family physician and healthcare executive from Northfield. I represent Isaiah in support of this bill. I will focus on the paid family leave portion of the bill. It was my experience as a family physician to commonly hear heartbreaking stories from people forced to choose between keeping their job and helping their loved one during a health crisis. Sometimes this happened with a medical emergency or an injury, but it was especially hard with cases of dementia, cancer, or other end-of-life situations. Sometimes several children would try to cobble together a schedule to help their mom and dad get the care they needed and stay at home, but often they weren't able to take enough time off work. These were terrible decisions for them to make. They just wanted to be there for their parents. But if they couldn't, it often led to hospitalizations or nursing home stays that just didn't have to happen. And these families were often not able to be together when they all needed each other the most. Sometimes a son or daughter would tell me that they only had 5 work days to use, and they would ask me to try to predict when their parent would not be able to talk to them anymore so that they could choose when to take those days. We can afford to do better than that. We can afford to let families be together with dignity and love at the end of life. These problems were especially hard for people who had poor paying jobs and little wealth. They were living paycheck to paycheck, and they couldn't pay their bills if they left work. They needed to be with their family, but they needed some income too. So I urge you to support House File 1200. Any Minnesotan might need it someday, and we all deserve to have it available. Thank you very much.
Dr. Christensen, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your testimony. Shannon Burns, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Shannon Burns, and I own a small business consulting agency. I work with small businesses in the West Central region of Minnesota and across the state. I'm a member of the Main Street Alliance. The best way to describe my feelings and the feelings of the small business owners I work with regarding the pandemic is that it's been an emotional roller coaster. We've gotten through the shock period of the last year and are working to adjust to this new normal. That makes the choices you make about the state budget and support for working families and small businesses even more important. With the right support, small business owners can start to figure out how to thrive now and in the future. The pandemic shined a bright light on the need for policies like paid family and medical leave that gives people the ability to take time to quarantine or care for themselves and their loved ones. So many small businesses that I work with have had to be without their staff for weeks at a time, sometimes more than once in the last year, and it's only put them even further behind. Luckily, the federal government provided businesses with a limited amount of paid leave, allowing businesses to pay their staff while they had to be off because they were sick, or had to quarantine, or had to care for a loved one. Being able to provide this type of benefit was a first for most small businesses in Alexandria and other areas of greater Minnesota, one that shouldn't end with the pandemic. Small business owners in greater Minnesota need to be able to continue to work to provide paid family medical leave to their employees, but they need the state's help to do so. Only the state can provide a big enough pool to make this type of benefit accessible and affordable for us. I believe that teleworking is going to be the new norm for white-collar employees. This is good news for greater Minnesota because it will help us retain and grow our populations, as people won't have to choose between living in a smaller community they love and working for a larger corporation with great benefits. It means, however, that businesses on Main Street, in Alexandria, and across our state is the key to our tourist industries. We have to compete more directly with large corporations for employees, actually all small businesses in greater Minnesota, which provide the majority of jobs outside of the Twin Cities metro area, will need to compete with large corporations that can afford to offer paid family medical leave programs. Communities from Alexandria to Albert Lea and everywhere in between need the state to help level the playing field for small businesses that are critical to our community's futures. Please support House File 1200.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Burns, for your testimony today. So that is the end of the people on my list for testimony. And I think we could go to member questions. And I know that Representative Hewitt had a question or comment. Representative Hewitt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Richardson, for such a great bill once again. And I just really want to tell you the response I've had from the business community and individuals that don't normally get a benefit like this. This is really going to open the door for them. And really, if you're thinking about it, it's $3 per week. I mean, this is a great insurance program to have that makes sure that you have that security. So, Representative Richardson, you will always have my support here, and thank you very much for carrying it.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson. I know we had a chance to hear the bill in the Early Childhood Committee. I do have continued concerns with the cost of the bill and the way that it is laid out. This morning, I had a meeting with the St. Cloud Area Chamber of Commerce on our legislative update and mentioned that this bill had been heard. And there are concerns, and I know we have a letter in our packet from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, concerned about the new payroll tax that would affect businesses in a time that we just need to reopen and allow businesses to move forward. But my question is actually for Ms. Fitzpatrick. You had mentioned that employees can't just take time off. They can't take that 12 or 24 weeks off, that there's a certification process. Can you just share a little bit more about that or elaborate on it?
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the claims process when a worker needs to take a leave, again, for either their own serious health condition or to care for the a seriously ill family member, the claims process in other states and as laid out in the bill does require a qualified healthcare provider as defined in the bill to certify the need for the leave and the duration of the leave. Again, that part of that is, you know, again, that we're making sure that this is being used for that the leaves qualify for the program.
Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. And I do understand that there are some benefits, and we are the Health Finance Committee, and so I understand that point. My concern, though, is for those businesses. We have such a workforce shortage as people are transitioning, especially during this hard time with the pandemic. We knew we had a workforce shortage prior to the pandemic. This has only caused that to widen. And so my concern is if there are employers that have employees that do qualify, where are they going to be able to fill those positions to continue their business? And it's not a question, Madam Chair, just a concern. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I'm gonna let Representative Richardson, I don't know if you wanted to respond to any of that, but the letter from the chamber was brought up. We are trying to focus on the health impacts here, but I don't think it's fair to you to have a member bring up some other concern and not let you respond if you want to. You don't have to, but.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Damuth, for your comments as well. You know, I just would say a couple of things in terms of the situation that we have right now. Individuals get sick. Right? They need to care for themselves. They need to care for their children. And what we see is when individuals don't have access to paid family leave, especially among low-income workers, they're three times more likely to like lose a job. So when someone is sick and not able to work, regardless of whether there's a paid family leave program or not, what we're seeing is the fact that people are not coming, not going back to work, or they're losing their jobs. And so I think it's just important to recognize that right now people are taking leave and oftentimes it's unpaid and it's putting them in very precarious situations. And as a result of that, where those individuals oftentimes end up is needing to rely on the social supports through the counties, which also increases the overall cost to the state as well. And from the business perspective, the COVID pandemic has told us and has shown a bright light on the fact that we needed to support businesses during the COVID pandemic. We've had several rounds of payroll protection loans to support businesses, and the people who power businesses also need a safety net as well as the businesses. And so I think it's important that if we, when we prioritize, providing support for businesses, that we remember that people power businesses and people have families and they should be able to take advantage of a safety net as well.
Right. Thank you, Representative Richardson. And we all have bodies that sometimes get sick. right? Yeah. So, okay. So I have now several members on the list. I have Bierman, Auckland, and Pryor. And I would like to ask members to please let's focus on the health aspects of the bill. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill and carrying this forward for us. There's a lot of things that we've heard today, and so many good things about the family paid family medical leave. I don't know where to start on it, but I did want to just reiterate, you know, the impacts that it makes on things like the newborns, the maternal health, the stronger workforce, especially for women. And the impact that this bill, despite being for businesses and workers, at least focused right there, the impact that it has on elders. And I think that Dr. Christensen deserves a shout out for his testimony. And I think that was very impactful. And I think we need to hear more about that, just in terms of how this impacts elders for all of our employees. But I wanted to make a few comments just from the fact that I'm a small business owner. And I saw this bill for the first time, and right away as I dug through it, I had some concerns too about it, initially about a cost to it. But the more I looked at it, the more positive I became over this, because I think it is so affordable. There's absolutely nothing that compares to it on the private market for insurance for business owners. And to Rep. Damuth's point on the fact that business owners sometimes are concerned about the fact that they're going to lose employees for a time period. You know, the fact is, in my business alone last year, I lost a key employee who had to have chemotherapy. I lost an employee who had to go and take care of aging parents out of state. I had an employee who was hospitalized and had heart and vascular issues and a very long home recovery. It's not a question of whether they're going to take the time off. It's a question of how we can help them manage that time off. And this bill addresses that in a way that is affordable for small businesses, remarkably so. And, you know, once we do make this law, I know you say it's a $3 split for employers and employees. In my company, I already plan to pay that full amount and make it part of my package for my employees, because it is so affordable. And it's something you can build in for your employees. And I already have lost employees who are younger, who want to start families, who want to work in our smaller community and a smaller business, but say, you know what, I need family leave. I'm going to be building a family, and so I need to do that. So if the chair would allow me, I do have one question for Ms. Fitzpatrick. Just wondering, with the study you provided from other states, can you tell us just what the majority of people who apply for a leave actually take? Is there any data on that particular aspect? I know it's 12 weeks and everybody says we can't lose people for 12 weeks, but I'm sure the actual time usage is much smaller than that.
Yeah, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, Yes, we have done some really significant modeling. The U.S. Department of Labor has developed some modeling software. We have the experience from these other states, and we have experience from workers now who have full pay and access to these kinds of benefits in their current employment situation to see what actually happens. And the average leave is around 6.6 weeks, not 24 a year. Most workers are only taking one leave over multiple years from the experience that we have. I think that also that U.S. Department of Labor work shows us, and I think people's own experience will show you, that actually workers really care about their employers and they care about their coworkers, and they don't tend to take more time than they absolutely need. So there's just a lot of evidence around what the reality is versus some of the fears. And I think once you dig into kind of see what actually happens in real businesses and real people's lives, that the kind of extremes that get brought up really don't bear out.
And Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Richardson.
May I add on to that? Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just add as well in terms of the data that we have from Minnesota that Ms. Fitzpatrick referenced about the 6.6 weeks. When we're looking at the percentage of workers who take leave on looking at an annual basis, it's only about 13%. So I think it's important to understand the, you know, not only are people you know, taking on average about 6 weeks, and that's looking over multiple years, but it's a small proportion of those who have the leave available that are taking it as well.
All right, thank you. So we have Representative Ackland, Pryor, and Morrison, and then we're going to try to give the final word to Representative Richardson and wrap up here. So Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple fairly simple questions. One is, when I see the eligibility conditions, it talks about a member's serious health condition, qualifying exigency, safety leave, bonding leave, or applicant's own pregnancy, and there are a couple other things. So my question was on the applicant's pregnancy, is a normal pregnancy considered an uncomplicated normal pregnancy, would that be a qualifying condition for taking this leave?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ackland, for the question as well. So in terms of the types of conditions that have been laid out within the bill, you hit on a number of them, the serious health condition piece, bonding for a child as with a child as well is another appropriate leave that can be taken. And so in terms of thinking about the types of leaves that would be eligible under this bill, it would be the type of leave that you would need a doctor certification for related to a serious health condition that would be lasting for more than 7 days. And so in terms of thinking through a high-risk pregnancy, you know, or complications related to that, that would definitely rise to the level of a serious health condition.
Okay. So just the way it's
worded.
Oh, I'm sorry. I always forget. Thank you. Thank you for your answer. I just feel like the wording there doesn't really qualify it, you know, as for a high risk, but that's something we can deal with. I was going to ask another question too, is it allowed during this time of paid leave to have a second job or have another job outside of the workforce that you're getting the leave from? Would that be allowed?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ackland, for the question. So in terms of we have individuals who have access to multiple jobs or working multiple jobs. And in terms of the situation, I think it would depend on sort of a case-by-case of, you know, what the job is, what the serious health condition is, and we would have to look at it from a case-by-case basis.
And I think Ms. that... Ms. Fitzpatrick, did you want to jump in? You look like you do. I don't know. No?
No need okay. to complicate it, but, you know, okay. if somebody breaks their leg and that's a serious health condition and they have two jobs, one of the jobs they may be able to do from home, but another they may not be able to do given that serious health condition. So I think, again, to Representative Richardson's point, it really depends on kind of what the health condition is and what the jobs are.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have Representative Pryor, then Morrison. Representative Pryor.
Didn't work. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back, and I realize Commissioner Malcolm's no longer part of our meeting today, but appreciated the comments that she talked about in terms of stress. I mean, we know if the cost of stress on an individual's life, especially in our BIPOC community, which is kind of unrelenting stress in many situations. But when you have the stress of an illness, your own illness, a family member's illness, then on top of that, the financial stress of worrying about supporting your family and yourself during that time, I can understand where this has a tremendous health benefit, and that it's something that Minnesota really needs to follow up if we really do care about the health of all of our communities and all of Minnesota. We lead the nation in many ways for our health, but we have huge disparities. And I think when we look at a bill like this, this is a profound way of addressing those disparities. And I think we have an obligation to go forward with this legislation. So thank you, Representative Richardson, for sticking with it through all these committees and all this time. I know that it's the right thing to do. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Pryor. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be brief, but a concern was raised about the cost of passing this bill, and I guess I'm concerned about the cost of not passing this bill. I just think about being an OBGYN over the years and seeing new moms and postoperative patients struggle with the balance of caring for their newborn or recovering from surgery, and the obvious and real need to have an income to provide for themselves and their families. And too often I have seen particularly my low income patients return to work before they should have for their health, for the health of themselves and for the health of their babies, with outcomes that are not optimal, often with a readmission to the hospital, often with the mental distress that goes along with that leads to other long-term consequences. We know that people who have access to paid leave stay in the workforce longer. This is what a humane and wise society does. We take care of each other. So I'm grateful to Representative Richardson for championing this bill, and I hope to see this become reality in our state.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. And I just want to make a brief comment, and then I'll go to Representative Richardson to wrap up here. You know, over my time and on sitting on health and human service committees in the legislature and even before, sometimes you hear kind of a theme that runs through our conversations that really amounts to, why can't people take care of themselves? Why don't they do what they should do to be healthy? What I would call sometimes somewhat of a blame the victim philosophy. You know, if people would just be responsible, we would have lower health costs, that kind of thing. And I think a bill like this really brings home how structural a lot of this is. That, you know, for as much as we like to think, oh, I'm an individual, I can control my destiny, a lot of what we think of is controlling our destiny is really the structures that are there for us. And so we're talking here about Minnesotans who don't have that structure when they need to take care of themselves, take care of their family, do the sort of self-help and family help that most of us expect. They are unable to do it because we don't support them in doing it. And then we want to blame them for their lack of success, for their lack of advancement, for their poor parenting or whatever it is, their bad health. So I think this is this whole bill just really shines a light on that. And I'm so appreciative of all the testifiers. I thought the testimony was incredibly moving. And Representative Richardson, thank you so much for this. I will give you the last word, and then we're going to have a vote on your bill. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it's just important to lift up and highlight that this bill is all about fairness and it's about equity. Because we know that the individuals right now in Minnesota that have access to paid family leave are the individuals that make the most money within Minnesota. And who's left out right now are the lowest income workers Women are disproportionately left out. Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and other workers of color are left out. And as I said before, unfortunately, we have a legacy in this country of creating safety nets with holes big enough for entire families and groups and populations to fall through. And so this is really about lifting up the fact that at some point, as the COVID pandemic has showed us, everyone is going to need help, be it a small business, a big business, and families also need that same sort of help and support. So thank you for the opportunity to present the bill today, and I just ask for member support.
Thank you so much, Representative Richardson. So I will renew my motion that House File 1200, the second engrossment, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
No.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer votes no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Daymuth.
No.
Daymuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg votes yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grünhagen.
No.
Grünhagen, no. Representative Keel.
No.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam, excused. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
11 ayes and 7 nays.
All right. There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you very much, Representative Richardson, and testifiers. All right. We're going to move on here now to the hear some more about the governor's budget, and we're going to here a few items. I think that Assistant Commissioner Anderson should be with us.
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Welcome back to the hot seat.
Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner, we hope it isn't too hot, but anyway, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Glad to be back this afternoon. Again, my name is Matt Anderson, Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. I have a few items from the governor's proposed budget that are budget-neutral items, so that wanted to highlight these for you. First, one is a kind of a technical change, but it aligns our state asset limits for the Medicare savings program with asset limits for the Medicare low income subsidy. And this is kind of a mouthful, but basically for low income enrollees on Medicare, there is support for helping pay for their Medicare premiums or deductibles and coinsurance. And we have an asset limit as to who qualifies to be able to get that financial support. Under Medicare Part D, Medicare law, federal law for Medicare Part D for pharmaceuticals, there is a limit as to how much low income subsidy limit, those asset limits. And federal law says that state asset limits can't be more restrictive than the federal asset limits. And right now we're fine. There's no immediate issue. But coming around 2030, 2032, the way that our asset limit is targeted and indexed, we will surpass the limit allowed by federal law. And so the suggestion is to make this legislative change now so that our asset limits are they stay as they have been, but if there comes a point in time at which they would cross over and exceed what would be allowed under the federal law, that the federal law would control, so we don't violate federal law. Again, this doesn't make any current fiscal impact. It doesn't change any benefits or issues for our residents, but it does avoid potentially very difficult legislation down the road if it would come to pass where the legislature would effectively have to be changing those asset limits or making our assistance more restrictive. I'll pause real quick for any questions on that explanation. I know it's a rather technical change, but again, it's one that we would recommend the legislature make now while it's easy and no one is harmed by it, than waiting until it's an emergency.
All right. Are there any member questions? It sounds like you could characterize this as set it and forget it.
Thanks. Yes.
That's probably what we'll be doing here. Set it, forget it. Any questions for members? Not seeing any. Okay.
Okay. Second issue is repealing legislation that was passed in 2016 regarding our Minnesota Care re-enrollment or renewal period. Minnesota Care enrollees enroll in the program and have to renew their eligibility every year during the open enrollment period that's administered by MNsure, so the November-December timeframe. In 2016, the legislature passed legislation requiring DHS to create a staggered renewal period so that people's renewals would come up a year from whenever they enrolled in the program and that it would be ongoing. That would allow us and our county and tribal partners who help us with eligibility determinations smooth out the workload across the year. You'd have an even number every month, roughly 1/12 of the population would be up for renewal, and you'd be processing those renewals instead of doing the entire population in roughly a 6 to 8 week period. We pursued that change with CMS and CMS denied that change in the Minnesota Care program. And so what we are recommending is that to make sure that our state law and the federal rules under which we have to operate Minnesota Care are consistent, we are recommending that change from 2016 be repealed so that we don't have the statutory language implying that we have rolling renewals when in fact we have an annual renewal period. And again, this is budget neutral. It doesn't change anything from the way it is now. It's just recognizing that the federal government won't allow us to do the plan that the legislature had previously enacted.
So, Mr. Anderson, is there any hope of going back and asking again? Because it sure makes a lot of sense to do it the other way.
Madam Chair, I think we can always open to having additional conversations with CMS. I think one of the challenges is that the basic health program, as enacted by the Affordable Care Act, was designed for people to have, if states opted for a basic health program, that this would be something that they would roll in instead of a qualified health plan sold through the Health Insurance Exchange or in Minnesota, MNsure. And so from CMS's perspective, that open enrollment period applies to qualified health plans, and so it should apply equally to the Minnesota Care program. So we can go back and have additional conversations and see if there is a new willingness on CMS to entertain this. But I think the interpretation of the law is that that it needs to align with what someone who is buying a qualified health plan would have the same experience.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for members? Okay, I don't see any, so please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next one is modifying the window of time for information gathering for inpatient rate setting. So inpatient hospital rates in the Medicaid program and our fee-for-service program are rebased, meaning that we take a year of actual experience from hospitals. We calculate for each hospital how many Medicaid patients did they have, what were their costs, what was the expected utilization and intensity of that utilization, and then we build the rates for each hospital based on that base year, and typically that base year is about 2 years behind our actual year. The challenge that we see or that we have is that using only 1 year it puts us in a position where, based on a single year's fluctuation in utilization, you can get some pretty big swings in individual rates among hospitals. And we are recommending that the pool or the base year for the hospital services that we would use for rate setting would be extended from the current 12 to 18 months. That would allow, This is information that we gather from hospitals that we use to set the rates. So again, for that base year, we have to collect all of their information and the services that they provided, which Medicaid enrollees they served. This proposal is to allow for hospitals to have 18 months instead of 12 months to provide that information to us. What the extra 6 months allows for is hospitals to have more time to correct any information that is incomplete, through the claims adjudication process, is changed, or services are denied for some reason, so that when we go to set the base rates for hospitals, when we do DSH audits for the federal government or other actions, we have a more accurate and complete set of data to work from, and that hospitals aren't crunched under the 12-month deadline to make sure that they've got all of their corrections made. Again, apologize for the beginning of my explanation of this and getting this confused with another proposal, but this is budget neutral. We believe that this would be something that hospitals would appreciate, the ability to make sure their information is accurate, and for our data folks and the people that have to use this information for a significant amount of our work for years after it's submitted, we'd like to have the most accurate and complete information possible. Apologies for the confusion, but happy to take questions and clear anything up.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question. So I'm assuming that the Hospital Association is in favor of this change and has some supporting it.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, I am told that MHA supports it. I have not had conversations directly with MHA, so I would want them to speak on their own behalf. But my understanding is that the association does support this proposal.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Representative Pryor, anything else?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like a change that makes sense.
Okay. Other questions for members on this? I guess I kind of wonder why it takes 18 months. You know, what do you get with the last 6 months that you didn't know? Or is this something where DHS has a question about something and then they can fix it? Is that more what it is? Or is it just they're working on it's kind of like, you know, I guess I'm somewhat thinking of this. You know, people do their taxes, right? And I know I'm not trying to make an analogy there because I know this is probably super, super complicated for hospitals. But, you know, there's diminishing returns, right, after a while. So could you just give us a little, how does the process work there?
So I'll try to give you an example in my turns. I have colleagues from DHS who are on the line as well, and invite them to jump in and clarify or correct anything that I get wrong. But generally, in a hospital setting, you have a patient. They come in, they get services, they're discharged, and then the billing and coding process begins, and you start to go through the billing. All kinds of things can happen between when the service is delivered and when the claim is finally settled and it's put into your cost report and all of your accounting is done. These things can include things like people who you thought had commercial insurance, and it turns out the commercial insurance denies that claim, and you find out later they were actually enrolled in Medicaid, and so you have to shift the claim from a commercial claim to a Medicaid claim and get it paid and move through the process. It can include things where depending on the coding of how the claim is billed, services that are included or excluded within the bill, and then all of the financial accounting piece as hospitals are going through their books and their reporting, particularly that Medicare cost report that is a significant report for them, used for multiple purposes, not just DHS, used for Medicare, used for tax purposes. And so trying to make sure that information is correct. It's not, I don't believe that the 6 months is really that significant that the data is radically different after 6 months. It's a matter of that time pressure of trying to get information through all of these processes and get it nailed down and corrected, you know, right by that 12-month deadline, where if you had a little bit more time and you had the ability for those cost reports to actually be fully completed and, the T's crossed and the I's dotted, that we would have information where we don't have hospitals asking to make corrections after the deadline or having to use data that we know had some corrections that didn't have an opportunity to be corrected.
Okay. Well, thank you for that explanation. That does help. Any other questions? Okay. Not seeing any. We're on a roll here.
Okay. The next one is also a very technical change, but we think an important change. So the state statutes clearly say that Department of Human Services, in setting our payment rates for outpatient hospital services, that we use a methodology, the time that the language was adopted was over 20 years ago, and said that we would use Medicare data in order to do that. Since that time, Medicare has begun using what's called the Ambulatory Payment Classification, or APC, system to set out hospital outpatient rates. According to our statute, we followed Medicare in doing that, but the statute doesn't clearly say that we will be using the APC system in setting our hospital rates. And so it's not that the statute doesn't allow us to do what we're doing now and that we have the authority to do it. It's rather for purposes of transparency and to be making sure that we're clear. We'd like the statute to say that we are using Medicare's APC system to set our outpatient hospital rates, and updating that language instead of some of the language that references a methodology that was used 20 years ago that isn't used by Medicare and isn't really being used by us. Again, this is budget neutral, doesn't change the rate methodology that we're using to calculate outpatient hospital rates. It won't actually, if the legislation is enacted, would not actually change any hospitals' rates, but it would protect us from challenges that we aren't using a 20-year-old methodology instead of the most current methodology.
Okay, great. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Quick question. Does the original language specify a methodology, or is it more generic? I'm asking because I'm anticipating 20 years down the road, if we codify ambulatory payment classification instead of just saying Medicare's current method, then we'll be out of date again the next time Medicare changes. So I'm wondering if general is better, but maybe it wasn't general before, it was specific in a different way. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we're the suggestion that we are making is in learning from the past 20 years and having that specificity in language, then becoming outdated. Our suggestion is to say that in the statutory language that we have the general language that our Medicaid outpatient hospital rates will be set using the most current version that Medicare is using. In other words, that we will stay up to date with Medicare and its methodology as we set our own outpatient rates. Not specifying a particular, in my language, I'm oversimplifying this, but we aren't saying Windows 7, You know, as we're saying, we're going to use the Windows system, and as Windows gets updated, we'll use the updated version. We're saying we're using Medicare's payment classification for how Medicare sets out patient rates. We'll use the same classification in Medicaid.
Representative Breyer?
Great, thank you.
Okay, great, good, great question. Future-proofing, sort of.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Okay, any other questions for members? I'm not seeing any on that, and I think that's the end of the topics for today. Am I right, Mr. Anderson?
Those, Madam Chair, those were all the topics that I had I had on my list to discuss, but okay. Happy to take questions if there are any.
Okay, well, I'm not seeing any other questions here today. So, okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. We appreciate your time and helping us so that we're prepared when we actually get into the actual budget, move the bill. We won't have to have the detailed explanations over again. So, all right. Well, with that, members, we've reached the end of our agenda for today. Appreciate your good questions and attention. It's just huge range of things in this committee. It's such a broad, health covers so many different things. We've gone from, something as, I would say impactful as the paid family leave bill, and then to these very technical topics, and all in an hour and a half. So thank you very much for your attention, and we will see you on Friday. That is our next meeting, 3:00 on Friday. So thank you all. We are adjourned.